This is a Hipsters of the Coast podcast. This Doom Travelers podcast is brought to you by Hipsters of the Coast, your destination for magic news, strategy, and entertainment. And by Casthaven, where you can build your magic collection like a pro. Visit casthaven.com for more information.
I guess I should do a proper introduction, right? Welcome all, welcome everyone to a new episode of Doomed Travelers, the podcast where we play Destiny and other video games, and we talk about Magic, the best game there is. This week we're going to cover two topics. We're going to start with scouting the Pro Tour, a very hot topic lately, and we're going to talk about fishing, not the kind you do on the water, but the kind that mean people tried to do with the Wizards website this week, a clone of the Wizards website on the internet. Yes, I am joined this week by Dave McCoy and Brendan McNamara, and I am your host, Rich Stein, getting killed in the Crucible. So let's start with scouting, and I'll ask you guys both the question. Would you rather, going into a tournament, into any round of a tournament, whether it's Friday Night Magic, Pro Tour, or whatever, would you rather know your opponent's entire deck, knowing that they know your entire deck, or would you rather everything be completely a secret?
I think it's definitely interesting if you watch, say, the top eight of a Pro Tour when everyone has all the deck lists, or it's the same thing happens at the top eight of a GP.
Yep.
And they share the deck lists, and there is that extra level of everyone knows, you know, what are the cards that they have that I need to play around, like if this is limited, or, you know, what are the specific cards that are best against me for Constructed. And that's nice, but I think in general, I mean, me personally, I try to limit the number of variables I'm having to track in my head during a game. And so if I know all the cards in my opponent's deck, in limited, for example, it's useful, but it can just kind of grind your gears to the point that it's harder to really focus on what's important. And what's more important in that situation is thinking about what are the cards that are really powerful that are hardest for you to answer or to deal with, or what cards you need to focus your resources around answering, or, you know, steering the game into a point where that card is not very relevant. And you don't need to know all of your opponent's deck to do that. And it's often nice, you know, if you're in a draft pod, you know what cards are passed. Or if you're playing in sealed, you know what kind of cards tend to be in good decks. And if you're at the top of the standings, you're probably sitting next to these people. And I'm always looking around and seeing what other people are playing, and I keep mental notes of some extent. But I would rather less people know less overall, because I think it's more interesting to put together, okay, what is in my opponent's deck, or what are the cards that I should be playing around? Spending time thinking about, well, the way they played this turn means they have Dissolve in their hand, for example, as opposed to just knowing, well, I know they play four Dissolves in their deck, and so I'm just going to always play around Dissolve. I think that that's a more passive way, and it can lead you into situations where even though you know they have Dissolve in their deck, they probably don't have it in their hand. But if you're not thinking about that because you just are reading a deck list, I think that's less interesting.
Yeah, so the question comes about because over the internet, this kind of started at the Pro Tour, Dragons of Tarkir, and it's kind of exploded over the weekend here. But what's gone on is pro teams, pro players, pro teams generally have been employing scouting at the Pro Tour. And to the extent at which most of the larger teams, so we're talking Pantheon team and the Ultra Pro team and some of the bigger teams, generally know the entire deck lists of many of the competitors on the Pro Tour by the second round. is what we're being told.
I mean, that was the claim. But I mean, Brian Kibler shared a screenshot of his notes that he shared with his team, and you know, whether or not you can take Brian Kibler at his word, I mean, I don't know. He seems like a trustworthy guy, but who knows? But and it was a screenshot of the iOS Notes app, and basically, right. it was Brian Kibler wrote down a guy's name who was on MTG Mint and the deck he thought he was playing, who he must have been sitting next to him, you know, like just saw it.
Right.
And a couple other examples of that, of just names and then archetypes and then maybe one card name that he thought was notable. And honestly, that is a much lower level of scouting than the original Reddit post implied. The Reddit post implied that these were spreadsheets with, like you said, entire deck lists, which as far as we know, isn't true. those are two entirely different worlds of scouting.
Yeah, it would be an amazing feat to accomplish what the Redditors had accused the pro player community of accomplishing. And I do say accused because the community seemed incredibly up in arms about this slight to the integrity of Magic tournaments.
Well, I think there is a little bit of truth to the allegations. I mean, I know I heard some from other people who played at Pro Tour or Figure Forge when I was there of at least one team who had an actual spreadsheet that they had access, like a Google Doc that they would access on their phone, and people would stories of people going to the bathroom before the round started and asking the judge for extra time so that they could go and look that sort of thing up. I think that happens to a slight extent, and I think that troubles people a little more than just the standard Yuya Watanabe is playing blue black in this tournament and he plays he's playing main deck Disdainful Stroke. That kind of stuff is really useful and really interesting and happens all the time. I don't think anyone has an issue with that. But there is some amount of, there's pressure on various teams to, use their resources maximally. And they'll say, they do have sometimes even people who are on the team but aren't qualified but maybe live in the area who would go to the Pro Tour and walk around in whatever matches they could see around the edges of the play area.
Sure.
So you're not allowed to walk in between all the tables. Well, but, they'll go.
On that note, I've heard rumors, and obviously a lot of this is all hearsay. None of us are on a professional Magic team, let alone one is with the resources of a team like Pantheon. But there have been stories of teams that have gotten people press passes so that they can walk around those areas of the tournament to do their scouting. And that's, it's hard to say what is and isn't accurate. A lot of this is going to be complete fabrication. Some of it's going to be true. But I think the bottom line is scouting at various levels is a thing that happens at the Pro Tour. And the community seems to be a little dismayed by this fact, which is kind of surprising because, like you said, Brendan, it's a thing that happens at a variety of levels already.
Yeah, I mean, this for me, playing in preliminary PTQs out here in Denver, I'm starting to get to know people, but there's an established scene. There's a lot of very good, PTQ grinder level players who have played in a few pro tours who are out here, and they all know each other. And I remember the first sealed PTQ I played at when no one really knew who I was, and I had a really good deck. And basically all the people I played were good, and all of them at least knew a general sense of, what the bombs were in my deck. And and the same way in smaller events, you sit next to everybody, and I do the same thing. And so I've played round four in a PPTQ when I knew that my opponent was splashing green in his white-black deck because he had the Fate Reforged Dromoka, and that's a card I didn't have a lot of answers to, and so I went into knowing game one because I'd sat next to him the round before and saw him win with it. This stuff happens all the time, and it's just at the Pro Tour that's more organization, there's more money on the line, and so it's going to be more professional because the Pro Tour is getting more and more professional, and I think people are just kind of surprised at how professional and serious it's getting, but it's the same thing that's always been going on. It's just technology.
Right.
You know, you have your phones. They can't make people.
Yeah,
they don't want to make people not use their phones because they want people to tweet.
Yeah.
And they, you know, they
Dave,
put like
Dave. Yeah, I there's a lot going on, but I mean, you know, I want to get Dave's opinion on what do you think the ideal situation would be, right? Because today we're kind of in this mixed world of some people don't know, some people do know. What would be the ideal scenario for you
in terms of a pro tour or any
in terms of the pro tour? Let's just talk about the pro tour here, because I think on a small scale, when you go to Friday Night Magic or even to a PPTQ, like Brendan said, the communities are pretty tight knit. People are going to know what other people are playing. It's very hard to avoid that. But at a pro tour, I think when you've got a lot of spectators, there's a lot more on the line. You can't really fault people for trying to get every advantage possible.
Yeah, right? I mean, I think at a pro tour level, scouting is going to happen, and it helps balance out some of the things that we force pros to go through for coverage's sake, like feature matches and having your entire draft recorded and broadcast
right.
to everyone. Meaning all you have to do is text your friend and say, hey, I'm playing Luis Scott Vargas next round. His draft was on. What did he draft? You know? So there are some pretty large disadvantages for being a pro player on top of the obvious advantages of having a team to test with and having a team to help you scout.
Right.
But, I mean, at lower levels, like a GP, most of the GPs I play in are in warehouses that you can't get sold. Reception in anyway, so it's not like you could even scout if you wanted to, but I mean, like BMAX said, it's people reacting to the professionalization of a competitive tournament. People who come in by themselves because they spiked a PTQ are already at a disadvantage against a pro player just because of the testing and the lack of high level players that they have access to. And I think people are reacting to that imbalance being worsened, perhaps, by the organized scouting that these teams do. But I don't think I don't think scouting's preventable. I don't think it's a bad thing. I think it's an advantage of players who are an advantage to players who care enough to organize. I don't think I think people are just reacting because they are unable or unwilling to put in the effort to organize their own scouting teams. You know, like everybody has an equal opportunity to scout. You know, it's not like these guys are asking a judge for access to desk list or deck lists or something like that.
Right.
They're just doing something that anybody could do, but they're organizing it. And,
right.
And that seems fine with me. It just means that they're both engaged and organized enough to pull it off.
So do you think the onus falls on players who do qualify via, say, an RPTQs that just happened this weekend? Do you think the onus is on them to organize themselves in order to give themselves a similar advantage?
Well, I mean, they have to do that for testing anyway.
Right.
So, I mean, I don't see why your organization should end before the Pro Tour. You know, like you're all at the Pro Tour together, theoretically, and you should be helping each other out at the Pro Tour as well. I mean, I also just don't think that there are any other legal solutions. Like, you can't ban scouting because you're going to look at the people who are playing next to you, and there's nothing, there's no feasible way of preventing you from relaying that to your teammates, nor should there be. And there's also no, knowing Wizards, there's no feasible way for them to disseminate digitally all the deck lists anyway, because they're submitted on paper, especially the limited deck lists, because you're doing it right before the event starts. You know, so how on earth are you going to disseminate all those deck lists? You're not going to be able to. You're going to have to do data. You're going to have to input all that data and somehow upload it to the site.
And then we can
guarantee
that
Everybody access to it. You know, like there's no way of leveling it. So I think you just have to up your game and organize yourself to the point, if you care enough, where you can get an organized scouting team together.
I guess I don't want to spend too much time on this topic. I think it's an interesting topic, but, Wizards is certainly limited in their options here. Like you said, the technological limitations or logistical limitations, there's, you know, not a whole lot they can do. It'll be interesting to see if they do try to take some kind of action. The only thing I could imagine them doing would be limiting the size of teams. But that seems like it's opening an entire can of worms with the legitimization or sanctioning of teams, which I'm sure is something that is very low on Hélène Bourgeot's list of things to fix. So it's an interesting topic, but one that ultimately I think is going to remain status quo. Any final thoughts on that one, or we should move on?
I mean, I think if there was an out, if the portion of pros from these scouting teams in top eights or winning the pro tours was out of proportion, I think it would be a bigger issue. But I mean, you see players you expect to do well, and then you see people who were loners or from smaller teams also do well. So, you know, it doesn't appear to, you know, we don't have top eights that are all Channel Fireball
players. All Pantheon.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, that's due to a lot of factors, but yeah, I think if that...
Yeah, no, I think you're right. If it, you know, there's clearly a theoretical advantage on paper. And obviously testing with a team gives you a big advantage, but like you said, that advantage is not translating into top eights at Pro Tours being entirely filled of players from large teams. So, which is definitely healthy for the team metagame. So moving on, we're going to switch topics completely and talk about fishing. That's fishing with a PH, like fat with a PH. For those of you who don't know, fishing is when people try to steal your login information by making a clone of a website you frequent, such as your bank's login website or the login website for your email, or maybe the fairly brand new login information for the Magic the Gathering website. So this weekend, last week, a link went around that was from a website with a URL that looked like magic.wizards.com. But then continued with .clonable.blah blah blah, and it looked like an article from Mark Rosewater that was touting the return of Mana Burn and another rules change that is pretty inconsequential. But the goal of this was to get people to click on the sign-in link to sign into their Wizards account. Thus giving somebody access to everyone's or these people's Magic accounts. Brendan, do you see the site? Were you fooled?
I did not see the site. The first thing I saw was a tweet from Mark Rosewater saying, "No, we're not bringing back Mana Burn," and referencing something about how there was this site, and I was like, "Oh." I immediately said, "Oh, someone has made like a phishing website, trying to, you know, trick people and at the same time do, you know, steal logins." And I really hate that kind of stuff, you know, as I think most of us do. And so I kind of rolled my eyes. And then later on, I saw some actual links to the website, and I saw the URL, and I said, "I will never click on that URL." There's too many. That is not magic.wizard.com/, you know, some sort of content. You know, I look at URLs, even though I'm not a programmer or trained in the details of how they work the way some of us are. I see that and I'm like, I know exactly what's going on and I'm just going to steer clear. And they're not bringing back Mana Burn, you know.
Right. Yeah, that was the interesting part, was that the story was really completely unbelievable. At least I felt it was more or less unbelievable. Dave, do you see the link? Do you see the site?
I opened up my email, and top of the list was an email from Matt Jones saying, "Why aren't we talking about this?" colon, and then a pasted link that was magic.wizards.com.clonezone.link/whatever. And I couldn't tell because there's no sarcasm or irony font on the internet. I couldn't tell if Matt was kidding or if Hunter's response was also a joke. I honestly couldn't tell because it was just that the link was so obviously not correct. So I was super confused, and so I wasn't trying to respond. But yeah, I saw it, and I was not fooled. Mostly because of, you know, internet safety dictates that you look at the URL of the link that you're clicking. But I mean, also, who's gonna believe that Amanda Burns coming back? that's just what blows my mind. Like even if you don't look at the URL.
Yeah, no, it turns out a lot of people actually believed the article and clicked the URL, and it is not a great thing, I guess. I saw the link from Matt, and I saw it, and I was like, this is clearly not going to take me to a real Magic article, but I'm interested to see where this does take me, so let's find out.
I was never asked for my sign-in information. Were people actually asked for their sign-in? Because it strikes me as, because Clone Zone is just a service for you, like creating fake, you know, like joke websites.
Right.
And this strikes me more as someone trying to rile up the Magic community than a actual phishing attempt. But I mean, I guess I don't know their motivations, and I didn't really come around long enough to figure out if they were actually trying to steal information.
Right. I mean, the website was very clearly not a Wizards website. If you looked carefully enough, it should have been pretty obvious what was going on. The terminology was wrong, but also lots of parts of the website were not accurate. They did not look like Wizards website, which is impressive because I think we've all been under the impression that Wizards website is actually not that great. So the fact that somebody wasn't actually able to just clone it in a weekend or however long they spent on this.
Yeah, well, I mean, what the service does is it clones the style sheets. So like the code that was written to structure and make the site look the way it does. So it clones all of that. It just copies it over and applies it to a new page. But what it was missing, from what I recall, is like the live elements. So you know, like the other articles or the little sections that aren't just controlled by static text. You know.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. For sure. So it's still a little shocking that people were so convinced that there were discussions going on about these rule changes. And the rules changes seemed absurd to me. We had a few discussions, Jess Sterba, who writes about EDH for our website, she was actually very intrigued by the idea of mana not emptying from your mana pool at the end of every phase. And I think that a lot of EDH players would be very interested in that because it means everybody gets to play with Azusa to an extent for free. So I guess if you were going to make a rules change to try to get people to come to your fake website, what rule would you change?
Damage on the stack.
You'd bring back damage on the stack.
Oh, I mean, I wouldn't want to bring it back. I think that would be hilarious.
Would be a better way to get people.
I don't know if it'd be better. I think Mana Burn was basically perfect.
I think they could say now you're allowed to play with 5 copies of a card instead of 4.
Yeah, that'd be pretty good.
Or purple being the 6th color.
Purple being the 6th color. Yeah, it's just, you know, I guess it's interesting what the motivation must have been, because even if the motivation was phishing, right, and they were trying to get people's login information, what end do you think, Brendan, you see this a lot, I'm sure, to what end does that information become useful?
I'm not sure that it's incredibly useful to have like people's logins to wizards.com. I mean, most people's logins, or a lot of people's logins, don't even work because they changed the site a few months back. And a lot of people have been trying to deal with the way they merge the accounts in their databases. But, you know, even assuming that it worked really well, like there's not a whole lot of information that is part of your public magic account that being able to access, you know, if you could go into the Planeswalker points site and know what turn they could figure out what stores you play at, and maybe if someone was
right.
Maybe if you were a known person who had a lot of valuable cards who traded, maybe they'd say, oh, this person goes to Tuesday Night Magic at this store every week, and they could use that to like track them and then go get them. But you know, that's about the, I think, the most sinister thing you could do with that. I mean, the other thing you could do is see if people use those same logons, like say at Star City Games, and then maybe access their premium or using their credit card that has information stored. That's kind of thing can happen.
So Brendan,
yeah, that was my assumption.
Sorry, Brendan, as a lawyer, what avenues? Because what's interesting about Wizards' response is that they immediately came out with this intention of seeking legal remedies for this website. And what on earth are they thinking they could get out of this? I don't quite understand. Like, the dude cloned their website. Like, that's, as far as I know, that's not fraud unless you are actually, you know, like stealing information, which didn't actually seem to be the point of this site.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of what Wizards does in this situation is part of really preserving their trademarks and a lot of the specific identity of Magic. And because trademark law, unlike, say, copyright law, you know, you make cards, the cards are copyrighted. There's not a whole lot they have to do. You know, there's back end for them and being able to enforce against infringers or people who are counterfeiting. But basically, copyright law just protects what you make. But trademark law, part of the law is that you have to put effort into protecting it. And especially if you have a trademark based around a game called Magic, you know, the more general or the more just kind of public domain or standard speak the words and the identity that you use are, the harder it is to protect it. And so part of it is they have to, you know, show their muscle, and they can't let people do those sorts of things. And there are also some laws called cyber squatting laws, where, you know, you can't go and buy, you know, magicthegathering.com or something if it was available, or if you go and get a website URL that's very similar to a company who has a registered trademark with that name on the website, and then you go and try and masquerade as them, you know, that there are criminal laws that prevent that. And, you know, as the owner of the real website, it's in your interest, both just in general, because you don't want people thinking that they went to a bad website and it was actually yours. You know, they want to protect their image and they don't want their customers to be injured by these fake sites. So there's real incentive for them to at least threaten legal action. I mean, they're not going to spend a bunch of money shutting these things down unless it's something real. Right. But it's just one of their incentives that they have. And a lot of the decisions that Wizards make are based around preserving the identity of Magic as a game.
Right, right.
It's so valuable.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's definitely a big part of the lawsuit against Cryptozoic, right? Is the fact that trademark law essentially requires them to protect their trademark, even if it's only a borderline infringement or possibly not even an infringement at all, because they have a lot more to lose if there is an infringement.
Yeah, and if they just said, oh, well, Cryptozoic's product isn't very good, we don't care about that,
right,
then someone else could do a better job. Then Hearthstone sees that and they say, oh, well, we're just going to start incorporating a lot of elements of Magic. And if Magic sues us and says that those are trademarks, we'll say, well, but Cryptozoic is doing it. These other people are doing it. This is just something that you've let get into the public domain, and you know, you can't claim that it's unique to Magic. And if that happens, I mean, that doesn't necessarily ruin Magic, but it makes other games able to try and make themselves more like Magic, to the point that they can, you know, steal or borrow or game players.
Yeah, and it's, you know, the gameplay is one thing. The thing with the Cryptozoic and the thing with this one, again, is it really comes down more to what it's like to be Magic, right? Because Magic's terminology is so ambiguous, they really need to protect the essence of what Magic is, and what it's like to play a game of Magic, and I guess in this case what it's like to be the Magic website. And it's not so much that they impersonated Mark Rosewater or that they used the they made a funny rules change, but it's that, you know, Wizards has to try to protect the brand of Magic and the feel of Magic more so than things like terminology like tapping and untapping. And with the Cryptozoic lawsuit, what they're trying to protect is the actual aesthetic and feel of playing a game of Magic, with the argument that playing Hex is almost indistinguishable from playing Magic. And in this case, you know, they'd have to try to make the argument that going to this website is almost indistinguishable from going to the Wizards website. And in that sense, they're probably correct, because you don't have to stretch too far to prove to anyone, whether it's a judge or a jury or whomever is presiding over your lawsuit, that somebody, anybody, could theoretically have been fooled by it. And that's kind of the crux of, at least with the Cryptozoic lawsuit, that's a lot of what's going on. So it's, we're probably going to see a lot more of Wizards protecting their, we're never going to see an end to it, that's for sure, of Wizards protecting themselves and taking an incredibly harsh stance immediately. And, you know, a lot of that, I think, has to come down from Hasbro being the mega conglomerate that they are. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Hasbro spent a lot of money to acquire Wizards of the Coast. So the profits from Magic, some of those go in to support Hasbro. And
yeah.
Wizards and Magic are a very lucrative and successful brand. And Hasbro has a lot of legal resources to be able to, you know, throw its weight around and make people think twice about trying to, you know, angle in on Hasbro's turf. Whereas when it was just Wizards being run out of, you know, Renton, Washington, or wherever they are, you could get further along before they have to like go hire someone to go do their legal work. You know, if it's just a bunch of game designers, they don't want to have to think about that. But Hasbro has a legal department. You know, Wizards itself has a legal department, but, you know,
sure,
some of that is through Hasbro, you know, and that's just part of the cost of running a large business. You know, if you have $1 billion or however much their just property and identity of Magic is worth, then, you know, you're foolish if you don't put money into proactively keeping it safe. And
no, definitely. So it'll be interesting to see if we get some more phishing scams. I certainly believe that the intent was to try to see if people's logins were the same against other websites. Possibly if people were using the same login or password for Magic Online or Star City Games, like you said, or to basically any website where they may then have credit card information saved. Mm-hmm. That tends to be the case when you have these kinds of phishing scams. So hopefully not too many people got caught. It was certainly one of those stories that's kind of funny and also kind of scary. So hopefully those of you listening will be more diligent in the future when somebody sends you a link, especially if it's about Mark Rosewater making a very silly announcement about Mana Burn returning.
Or maybe the moral is don't go to Paris for a month and not play Magic, because when you come back,
yeah,
you're tricked into thinking that the rules have changed.
Very surprised that Matt had come across this and did not realize what was going on.
Good thing he's not here to defend himself.
It's true. Matt has returned from his excursion to Paris. He is a changed man. And he will hopefully be joining us next week to tell us why he's probably never going to play Magic the Gathering again.
He has to digest all his cheese first.
Yeah, that's true. He does have to digest all the cheese first. Now, we're very excited that Matt's back in the States. We're excited that Brendan's going to be joining us full time. And we're excited that Modern Masters is coming up. Now that this Dragons of Tarkir thing is, you know, kind of run its course. We got a lot to talk about in the next few weeks, so hopefully you'll tune in. And for now, guys, I got this turning the thing off figured out. I found a website that somebody sent me. I just log in, I give them my PlayStation Network ID, and it'll turn off my stream. So I got it figured out. I don't need any help anymore.
That was terrible. Well done.
I thought long and hard about that one.
Hey Guardians, thanks for tuning in to the Doom Travelers podcast. You can find more at doomtravelers.com or follow at Doom Travelers on Twitter for show updates and other nonsense. Make sure to subscribe to Hipsters TV on YouTube for videos of our previous episodes. And don't forget that you can find audio-only versions of the Doom Travelers podcast on iTunes. For your host, Rich Stein, and Matt the Obliterator Jones, I'm David Bones McCoy. See you next time.